Hello, my friends, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Trusted Friend Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I took last week off of publishing an episode because I just needed a break. And these fabulous women that I meet and whose stories I share need to and deserve the best of me. And if I can't edit an episode with all the gusto and energy that I need, then it's time for me to take a break. Today's episode with Danielle was an interview done at 7 a.m. And anyone who knows me personally, I am not a morning person. So you may hear me as my voice slowly wakes up as I'm asking her questions. Again, I could visit and chat with these women all day. So amazing. So many inspiring women. Get ready to be captivated by Danielle's journey from the challenges of a tumultuous childhood, including being kidnapped by her mother, to the highs and lows of motherhood, postpartum struggles, and the trials of military deployment, and how she's taken her experiences and how to navigate life and put it in her book, Unstoppable Grit, that is now available on Amazon. I'm your host, Lisa Helton, and you're listening to Unstoppable with Danielle Cobo.
I'm Danielle Cobo, and I am a military spouse. I'm a mother to thrill-seeking twin boys that are 6 years old. I promise you they have more energy than a squirrel on a triple espresso. There's no shortage of energy with my kids. And I'm also a business owner. So what I do for work is I do speaking full time. I'm also an author and I'm a podcast host. I'm the host of the Unstoppable Grit podcast with Danielle Cobo.
That's perfect. They're probably like a double espresso.
Oh, I should say double. Yeah, that would make sense. Huh? They go to school all day. They do karate and then they come home and we're doing relay races to continue to burn out that energy. So still think it's that triple.
Yeah, there you go. I know when we chatted, some of the things that you spoke about was the relationship you had with your mother and your father. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and your upbringing. Where did you grow up? And what was that like for you?
So I grew up in Southern California, specifically Dana Point, Orange County, which is an absolutely beautiful town. It was quiet. It was quaint. At the time, it was filled with orange groves, which was absolutely beautiful. Now it's grown into this big city of Orange County, where it's now known, of course, because the Real Housewives of Orange County and some of the other shows that have come out of it. But it used to be farmlands and it used to be orange groves, which, yeah, right on the cliffs of the beach, which was really pretty. And I would say my upbringing had a blend of beauty and brokenness. I was raised by my mom, and my mom was somebody who I admired and respected for so many reasons. She was a single mom. She was going to school full time. She was raising me. She was serving at a restaurant. So I believe strongly that my drive, my determination, my grit and tenacity came from what my mom role modeled for me. She went from having absolutely nothing, where we were living in a one-bedroom apartment. I slept in the living room. Most of our meals were either SpaghettiOs and mac and cheese, and we shopped at thrift stores, and we were very frugal. We had modest upbringing. And I saw her go from having this modest upbringing to getting her degree and going into the corporate world in pharmaceutical sales and rising up the corporate ladder, becoming a manager in the 1990s. So a female manager, 1990s for a Fortune 500 organization. Wow. Was not as much as it is now. So she really was the pioneer for women in the workforce. And there's so many reasons why I admired her for that, but there was also a brokenness between my mom and I's relationship. I didn't know it until I was 15 years old, but my mom kidnapped me from my dad. My dad went to come and pick me up, and our house was completely empty. And I don't know the reasons as to why she took me from my dad. I don't know how long they fought for. I do have memories of my dad trying to pick me up, like trying to come and pick me up. I remember him honking outside the door and my mom not letting me to go see him. She would hold me back. I don't know the reasons for it, but I do know that for much of my upbringing, I felt a lot of unworthiness because I felt that he had taken off on us. I felt he had abandoned us. I felt like I wasn't worthy of unconditional love because so much of my love was conditional with my mom on whether I was achieving or not achieving in certain areas within my life. So that's why I say my upbringing was it was a beautiful, but it was also a very broken upbringing.
Are you an only child?
I am an only child between my mom and my dad. My mom ended up getting married for the second time. I have two stepbrothers, but then she ended up getting divorced with him, but I still call them my brothers. And then my dad is remarried. And so I have a stepbrother and stepsister on that family as well. Now my dad and I have a very close relationship. Unfortunately, my mom has passed, so there's never been a time in my life where I've had a relationship with my mom and my dad at the same time. But I do have a very great relationship with my dad, and my stepmom is absolutely amazing.
Oh, that's good. Did you ever find out from your dad what it all happened?
No, I think for my dad, he's very reserved when it comes to talking about emotions. And I believe a lot of that comes from the pain that he experienced. I know it was very difficult for him. From what I've heard from my stepmom, I know that it was very difficult for him to even talk about it. I try to ask him some questions, but he diverts the conversation. I'm hopeful that when him reading my book, and I do go into like my side of the story and like what my perspective was growing up, I'm hopeful that it will open up some conversations for us so I can get a better understanding of what took place. All I know, I do have memories. So obviously there's two sides to every story. I've had one side from my mom, most of my upbringing, and now I'm hearing my dad's side a little bit. But there's also the memories that I have. And a lot of the memories I do have are of my mom not letting me see my dad, and also some manipulative events that took place after on in my 20s. So I do know that my mom did suffer from mental health, so they're probably relatable to that.
I'm sure your dad might open up once he hears your side, because he's probably afraid, because he's, okay, does she blame me? He probably feels a sense of guilt. I should have fought harder. But maybe once he knows your side, he'll feel safe to be like, okay, this is not what happened. This is what happened.
There's a part of me that was very angry. So when I first met him, when I was 15, he just showed up at my high school randomly one day.
Oh, wow.
So all of a sudden, the principal called me out of class and said, I just want you to know that there's a man here who says he's your father. He's proven with paperwork that he's your dad. And if you want, you can meet him right now. I was 15 years old. It was probably 3 days before Valentine's Day, I think, is when it took place. I was a sophomore in high school. And I remember saying yes, walking outside, and immediately he just gave me this big hug, and we both just bawled our eyes out. It was just, tears cannot be held back from that moment. And I was so grateful to finally meet him. And at the same time, I was still so angry at him, because I felt that he had chosen another family. I felt that I wasn't good enough to be part of his life. And for so many years, I was angry at him that it took me some time to really understand that there are two sides to every story. And you mentioned too, like, maybe there's some guilt for not fighting hard enough. I eventually did find out, because there's a lot of times where I go, why didn't you just keep fighting for me? Why wouldn't you go to the court and keep fighting? And eventually one day, I remember him telling me that he just at some point ran out of money fighting for the court system, which I understand it's very expensive to do a custody battle. And then one day he told me that eventually what had taken place was the attorney had basically said, if you continue to fight for Danielle, I'm concerned that her mom might take her out of the country. And then you'll really never see her. I think that might be the defining moment when he just said, okay. And I've heard that he used to go to the playground and he used to watch me, but from afar, because he couldn't be around me. Again, this is all what I've heard through family members. So I'm sure there's truth, but also I don't know all the details. But I am hopeful that him reading the book, I'm a big believer that I would never wish anybody to go through that circumstance of being taken from their parent. And at the same time, I don't blame him at all. I think that a lot of what I've experienced in my upbringing, like many of us, shapes us into who we are today. And I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for those challenges and life experiences that I've had. And my hope is that one day he'll just see that in order for us to have a very strong relationship and to heal through this process is being able to be open and to talk about the past. And help me get a better understanding of who I am. I didn't meet my family until I ended up not meeting like my grandma and my aunts and uncles and cousins until I was 18.
Yeah, your grandma must have been heartbroken.
Yeah, my grandma, my family on my dad's side is very close too. They do everything together. So I can't imagine how difficult it was, not only for my dad, but for my entire family. Interesting enough, you mentioned about photos. My mom threw away every single photo of my dad and I from the ages between 0 and 2.
Oh,
so I have 3 photos of my dad and I. One of them was my dad had, and 2 of them came from an aunt. So yeah, my mom, really, if you look at my childhood, all of my pictures are either of just me or of just my mom. There's no pictures of my dad and that side of the family.
She was literally trying to erase him from your life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she really was. And I don't know what caused her to be that angry. But either way, it doesn't matter. It's one of those things where you hear a lot, but also you also got to judge by your own experiences of that person. And my dad is such a passive person. He is not one to, I don't remember any physical abuse. I don't believe there was any physical abuse. That's just not who he is. So I can't imagine what other reason there would be why she would take me from him other than just selfishness.
And if she struggles with mental health, the way she sees the world is different too,
so.
Right? And so yeah. Her accusations might be as far as what she sees. Yeah. That's sad, but I'm glad that he even had the courage to stop by in high school and be still try to be a part of your life. But it just goes to show you the great love when he knows she can take you out of the country and then I'll lose her forever. So to back down like that must have been incredibly hard. And like you said, it's not fair because it costs too much to fight for your children and to fight for custody. And they don't take into consideration a lot of dads.
Yeah. So my advice to anyone who's listening right now, I know that divorce is hard. I've been divorced and I know how hard it is. I've never done it with kids. So I will say I've been married for almost 11 years now, and I've never done it with kids. But the one thing that I will say from being a child and seeing divorce firsthand on multiple occasions, do everything to put your kids first. I know that there's got to be anger towards that other person that you're married to. Obviously, there's a reason why you're getting divorced, but do everything you possibly can to put the kids first. That's what it's about, because the damage that it did to me on my self-esteem and me feeling like I didn't know what unconditional love was until I became a parent. And I see in so many different ways. There goes into the four attachment styles. And I talk about this in the book, but there's different attachment styles of there's secure. And then there's three different that are insecure attachment styles. And I can see in so many different ways how my upbringing has influenced the three different insecure attachment styles that I have right now. Not feeling like I'm worthy of love, not feeling like I'm adequate, being very guarded and not wanting to get too close to people because I believed for so long that no matter what, whoever loves me is eventually going to take off on me or eventually going to hurt me. And that's not true. And so I always say for people that are going through some sort of divorce and custody, just you want to be angry at the person that you're divorcing. I get it. First and foremost, anger is not going to serve you. Like at some point you've got to forgive. And I'm not saying forget whatever actions the other person took. But when you hold on to anger, you're just poisoning yourself. You're not poisoning the other person. And you're only poisoning the people that are on the aftermath of what that anger is.
It does a lot of damage. And people just don't realize that. And they don't realize the importance of having a father in your life either as a young girl.
Yeah. Father-daughter dances. I hated them. I hated it. I felt like I felt so left out, so lonely.
Yeah. And then you said I didn't know you were married before. So I'm sure obviously a lot of your childhood played into, I'm guessing, that marriage.
Yeah, a lot of my childhood played into the relationships that I was in. I would stay in relationships longer than I should because I was insecure. I felt nobody else is going to love me. I felt that eventually everybody would cheat or everybody would, that marriages don't last. I would, as soon as I felt like I was possibly going to get hurt or I was getting too close to somebody, I would run away from the situation as well. So there's so many different ways that my upbringing was showing up in the relationships that I was in for so long. And I even see it in my marriage now. Gratefully, my husband comes from, his parents have been married for 40 something years. I don't even know, 45 years, been married for a long time. They have a very healthy relationship. And he knows, and I've been open and honest about him, but it's taken a lot of therapy to get to the point where I've been open and honest with him and say, hey, these are my shortcomings and this is what it comes from. And I'm working on it, but he's aware of it. He's supportive. And he just knows that, okay, Danielle, you're getting into that mode again where you're starting to run away. What's triggering it? And we talk about it. And that's hard. That's different for me as well to actually talk about why I'm putting that guard up.
Yeah, it is helpful. I know that I come from my family. My parents have been married forever, too. And my husband, the same thing happened. It really does affect your marriage, how you grow up and how you handle and how you have conversations and how you argue, how you solve those concerns. Do you run away? Because we definitely tend to, okay, I'll hurt you before you hurt me.
Yes.
Protect ourselves from that.
And that's one of the reasons why I go into the four attachment styles in the book, is because I believe that when you have a good, our most formidable years are between the ages of 0 and 8. That's where that nature nurture comes into play, was in those most formidable years. And so I believe that when we truly understand and look back and reflect at our upbringing, and we understand how the different events took place in our upbringing and how it's shaped us into who we are today, we can have a higher level of self-awareness, emotional intelligence, so that we can make pivots when we start to see that we're being triggered by something. And so that's one of the reasons why I go into it in the book. And I believe that it's going to help a lot of people.
So in the book, do you tell your story and then analyze it? Like, how does it run down?
Each chapter in the book is a story, a learning lesson, and then how can that person apply it to their life? I want people to walk away reading the book and going, okay, now I have the tools. Okay, I've heard this person's story. I can relate to this person's story in one way, shape, or another. They may not be able to relate to being able to be kidnapped, but maybe they have that feeling of unworthiness or insecurities that are showing up. They can relate to that. Okay,
Abandonment issues.
Yeah. And so then from there, it's how can they take the story and the learning lessons that I experience and then the tools that I provide so that they can help transform their life for the better.
Cool. And I like that. I like that format, because just getting instructional books or how-to books
and you're like,
yeah. And you're like, what does Danielle know about abandonment? What does she know about? She's just a life coach that just went to school to be a life coach. She knows nothing about what I'm going through.
Yeah.
And you definitely have experienced a lot, and you met your husband, you got married, and have you always wanted to be a mom?
I've always wanted to be a mom. Yes.
And how exciting were you to find out you were pregnant? And did you know you were having twins right away? That process easy or hard?
No, it was hard. Actually, you go through life trying, you get told your upbringing, don't get pregnant. And then my husband and I were married for, gosh, I don't even know how many years we were married, but we basically tried for 3.5 years to get pregnant and we couldn't get pregnant. I was pumped with so much infertility drugs. I felt like I was a completely different person, because I would cry at the drop of a dime. I would have hot flashes because of all the infertility drugs that I was on. But eventually we did one round of IVF and we got pregnant with twins. And we didn't know the gender though. I chose to not know the gender. I was so grateful and blessed to be pregnant. I just wanted to enjoy that moment. So when they arrived, I just remember this moment where they pull one baby out and they're like, it's a boy. And I got to experience that. It's a boy. And I didn't know. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm having a boy. And then they pulled the other one out and they go, it's a boy. And I go, wait a minute, what? And my husband said that I just looked so confused, because I thought I was having girls. That was what I thought I was having. Clearly I had two boys. So it was such a beautiful moment to experience that surprise. And you only really get so many surprises in your life, true surprises. And that was one.
Yeah, I liked having it be a surprise. I think I've only found out with one. I can't even remember. It's been so long ago. But I do agree with you, though. My last one, they said it's a boy. And I'm like, no, it's not. I was like so mad, because I thought it was going to be a girl. And my husband's like, don't you want to hold him? I'm like, nope. I thought it was going to be a girl. It's just like, I think it was just because of the drugs. Like, are you sure you don't want to hold him? I'm like, nope. Don't want to even look at him. And this is my fifth. What mother doesn't do that, right? I just refused, because I knew as soon as I looked at him, I'd fall in love. But I'm like, no, it was supposed to be a girl.
Not what I envisioned in my head.
I know. You get all psyched up, right? And then as soon as I held him, I love him to death. And he's the best thing that ever happened. But yeah.
I never got to experience that moment of holding my babies for the first time, because mine were born 6 weeks premature.
Oh, wow.
So they pulled out one, and then I had an emergency C-section. Because my water broke. So they pulled out one, immediately took him over. There was 5 nurses on him, plus one doctor, immediately took him over. And then they pulled out the other one, and he was blue. And I was just going, oh my gosh, I was just praying, can I please hear that cry? Please hear that cry. Eventually I hear the cry. They rush both of them straight up to the NICU. And my husband looks at me, he's like, what do you want me to do? Stay with you or go with the babies? I'm like, go with the babies. I don't care about me. Go with the babies. Just please. So he rushes up to the NICU. I don't get to see them for 1.5 hours because I was in recovery. And I remember being rolled up to the NICU and seeing them, and they're in these incubators and they've got breathing tubes on. They've got feeding tubes in their nose. I'm hearing all this beeping noise and I am just terrified. just please make sure that these babies are okay. And they spent 17 days in the NICU. So what would happen is you needed to have 3 straight days of no desaturation, which was desaturation is when their O2 levels would drop so much that they would forget to breathe. So you would unwrap them, you would tickle their feet a little bit and remind them to breathe again. And so we needed to go 3 days without desaturation before we could take them home. And they ended up spending 17 days in the NICU. And they weighed at 5 pounds, 3 ounces and 4 pounds, 10 ounces.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it would be hard. I'm sure you're just longing to hold them.
Yeah. All I wanted to
hold them, because I know that when they put the skin to skin, that it really helps them to remember to breathe and helps them to get back there.
Yeah, so our house had flooded a month before they were born, and not just our house, their room, their nursery with their nursery bathroom was the room that flooded, the toilet flooded in their room. So what we would do is we would go to the NICU all day long, and then we would come home and our house was under construction and repairs from the flood. So then as it was starting to get repaired, we would be building the crib, we would be doing anything else we needed to do because the nursery had not been set up. They were born 6 weeks early. I knew they were going to come early, but not 6 weeks early. And so we were just burning the candle at both ends. And the hospital was a level 3 trauma hospital for the NICU. So it took us an hour to drive there. So we would drive an hour every day to the hospital, spend all day with them, come home, then be up till about midnight cleaning up the house and getting the house ready for the babies to come home. And it was a construction zone, so it needed to be pristine clean when they got home because they had respiratory issues. So because they had been on breathing machines and one of them came home on a heart monitor, one of them needed to be on a heart monitor for a month. And then right after they got home, just 2 weeks after they got home, I remember walking through the hallway and I received this excruciating sharp pain in my stomach. And I remember hunching over, basically crawling to my bed while screaming for my husband. And they rushed me to the hospital. I end up having gallstones because I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I wasn't taking care of myself because I was so worried about the babies. And I ended up having
your
gallstones.
Milk coming in.
Milk was not coming in.
Oh, it wasn't.
Nope. I distinctly remember somebody telling me that if a mom doesn't breastfeed, it's because they're not trying hard enough. No. I met with the lactation specialist 6 different times. I was eating the oatmeal cookies, the milk thistle tea. I was power pumping 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off, doing that for an hour straight every 3 hours. I would do skin to skin while pump. I did everything I possibly could. And then the next thing that everyone tells me is, it's because you had twins. No, it would take me 4 pumping sessions to get 1 feeding for them. I wasn't making enough for even 1. So I tried so hard. And that was the other thing that was exhausting me out, was just the pressure for that. Eventually, what happened was I ended up going to the hospital. I ended up having gallstones. As I'm laying in the hospital bed, the doctor's coming into the hospital and he's saying, you need to have, or to my hospital room, and he says, you need to have surgery. You have gallstones. And as he's telling me this, I look up at the TV and in bright red letters, it says Category 5 hurricane headed to Tampa. And it was Hurricane Irma. And it was in the middle of the summer. And as I'm looking at him going, we have a hurricane coming. What do I do? I get a call from my husband. And my husband says, I've just been activated. Because he's a Black Hawk pilot for the Army. I've just been activated. I need to move my helicopters up to the Northeast. And I need you to come home and take care of the babies. So I remember looking at the doctor and I said, I can't have surgery right now. And he said, you've passed the gallstones. So that's good. But it's not a matter of if you're going to have gallstones again. It's just a matter of when. So as soon as this hurricane passes, you need to come back in. You need to have surgery. You need to get your gallbladder removed. So I go home. I call some of my friends. We board up my entire house. So all the windows are all boarded up. This was our first hurricane because we had just moved to Florida. My in-laws were visiting. They were staying with us. We lost power for 4 days. We ended up buying a generator, an overpriced generator on the side of the road because all the generators were sold out. All the gas was gone. All the grocery stores had been emptied out. So I remember buying a generator off the side of the road for $1,000, double the price. But grateful I got it because one of my boys was on a heart monitor. He had a monitor to make sure that his heart was beating. So we hooked it up to the generator. and we sweated it out. Because remember, this was the heat of summer. So we're in Florida, 100% humidity, 98 degrees, hurricanes coming. And we ended up sweating it out in our house for 4 days straight with our house completely boarded up. And it was so hot. And but that's what spiraled all these series of events between the house flooding to the NICU to the gallbladder to the hurricane to the not being able to breastfeed ended up spurring into postpartum depression and also lack of sleep. It would take me an hour and a half to feed one and then an hour and a half to feed the other. And then I would have an hour break. And that was round the clock. They didn't sleep through the night for the first 6 months. So I was so sleep deprived. I was so deprived of taking care of myself that I ended up getting severe postpartum depression. And I cried every single day at 5 o'clock at the dinner table, just bawled. I just said, I can't go through and I can't do another night of not sleeping. And they say, sleep when your kids sleep. My kids weren't sleeping though, because they you do one, then you'd feed the other. So it was, yeah.
It was did your lot. In-laws help out a lot? Having them there, I'm sure helped.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, you would have died if you didn't have any.
I know there's twin parents out there that do it on their own, and I have the utmost respect because these two little babies wore out 4 grown adults. I ended up hiring a nighttime doula to help with the feeding so that I could get sleep because my husband was working full time, so he couldn't do the nighttime feedings. And my mother-in-law and I were exhausted. My father-in-law has leukemia, so like he really does need his sleep for his own health. So these two little ones were wearing out my mother-in-law, but they were so helpful. My mother-in-law would cook dinner for me each night. She would help do the laundry. What I'm most grateful for is she took care of me so that I could take care of my babies. And that was the most, I look back and I'm so grateful for that because she could have easily been like, well, let me help take care of the babies. No, she took care of me.
Yeah, and that's a really good point too. I was talking to a grandmother who was given advice and she said, when you go to help your kids or your daughter-in-laws that are having kids, ask what you can do to help them. Let me do the laundry. Let me make the meals. Let them hold their baby.
Yeah.
Because you've got lots of time later to hold the baby and hold the grandchild. Take care of them and ask what you can do to help them. And you clean and you cook and then you get out of their way.
Yeah, she would come over. She would do laundry. She would cook me dinner. She got to hold the babies when I would go shower. But she really took care of me. And I love that advice. I absolutely love it because it gives the mother an opportunity to bond. And that's what's so important.
Yeah, instead of taking that from her, I'll settle the babies for you. I'll do this.
No, the moms need to learn how to do it. They need to learn how to do it on their own. And we call her BB. But it's not as though she's got a shortage of love from my kids because when BB's around, I'm like chop liver to BB. They love their BB. So you're right. As soon as they start to get older, that's really when that relationship forms with the grandparents.
Yeah, I like that, especially going through postpartum depression. It's not a topic that's talked a lot about. And what did that look like for you and how you got through it, actually, other than your mother-in-law obviously taking care of you really helped.
But. Yeah, there's 1 in 7 women experience the baby blues. And I believe that the more that we talk about postpartum depression and spread awareness about it, the more that people will feel like, oh, I'm not alone. And when I am going through it, I can talk to somebody because somebody else shared with me that they were going through it. Because I've been so open and honest about my postpartum depression, I can't even count how many people have reached out to my husband and said, I think my wife has postpartum depression. What do I do? And they'll reach out to him and then I'll help give some advice. And then, or the women will call me directly. And I'm so grateful because I don't think that we should do this alone. I think that we should be there to support each other. And so that's one of the reasons why I share the story in the book. And one of the reasons why I share the story in the book is because I talk about the steps that I took to overcome postpartum depression and how that helped set me up for success the next year when my husband was deployed in Iraq for a year. I was leading a team for a Fortune 500 company and I was traveling 60% of the year. And my twins were 2 years old at the time, between 1.5 and 2.5. So I talk about what did I learn going through postpartum depression on how to recover from burnout so that when my husband was deployed, I had the tools to prevent burnout when he was deployed. And not only did I survive that year that he was deployed, I thrived. And I believe that we can absolutely have a very successful career and be a very present mother in our kids' lives if we have the right tools to be able to create balance in our lives.
What did that look like for you? What did that balance or harmony look like for you?
For me, it was, I knew that number one was getting a great support system. I learned while going through postpartum depression that asking for help is not a sign of weakness. Asking for help is a way for somebody else to experience joy and happiness. And the reason being is if you look at research out there shows that people that do volunteer work live happier lives. We are more fulfilled when we are helping others. So when we ask for support and we say something like, hey, I'm just having a rough day. Will you come over and just sit with me? Or, hey, can you help watch the kids for a second? You're actually giving somebody else an opportunity to experience joy, fulfillment, purpose, feeling wanted, feeling needed. And so I think that's a big mindset shift that we get to work our way around, that asking for help is an opportunity for connection. Some of the deepest relationships that I have now are from that year when I was going through postpartum depression, the year my husband was deployed. I asked for help. And because of it, some of these people that I'm friends with during that time are some of my closest friendships. And I'm so grateful. And I love it when they ask me for help. I'm like, absolutely. What can I do? I'm here to help. But also being very forthcoming and saying, hey, if I know that somebody's having a rough day, okay, I'm coming over. It's either I'm going to bring you something or I'm just going to sit by you today. You don't even have to talk. Or, hey, I'm just going to help do things around the house so that you can sit and relax for a second, whatever it is. So the first one is asking for help. The second one is being very intentional about what's important to you. So for me, I knew that if I was going to be traveling for work, there was two things that were important to me. One of them was to have stability in my kids' life. So we had a full-time nanny. And anytime that I was traveling, they were either with my nanny or they were with my in-laws who lived close by, or I would fly my parents out sometimes. And so that was very important to me. So I was very intentional about that. The second one was I was intentional about ensuring that my kids either saw me, I would either wake them up or I would put them to bed. So sometimes that meant red-eye flights so that I would get home to be able to wake up with them in the morning. But a lot of my overnights were just one-night overnights. There were times where I would be gone for 1 week and then I'd come home for a week and then I'd be gone for another week. But that's when I would fly my parents out or my in-laws would be there. Like, it was all hands on deck during that time. But I was very intentional that I wanted to ensure that my kids knew that I was there 100% for them, that I'd be there to wake them up, that I'd be there to put them to bed, that I'd be there for the bedtime stories. And I was very intentional about always having something on the calendar. So I knew that if I was going to be gone for a couple days, then I'd be like, okay, this weekend, we're going to do Legoland together. And we're going to be very intentional about spending quality time together. And I still do that today. I look at my calendar ahead of time and I look at, okay, this particular week, I've got a speaking engagement coming up. So the next couple days after that, I'm going to block my calendar and my kids and I are going to go do something special together, so that they're still getting that quality time with me. Even though it's not every single day, it is the quality time of what really matters. So the first one was asking for help. Second one was being very intentional. And the third one was giving myself grace. I had full intentions of, I bought a Peloton and I'm going to work out every single day. I'm going to get in great shape. And what I realized was I was able to give myself grace. And at that time, I needed sleep. That's what I really needed during that time. I was exhausted. So giving yourself grace that sometimes what you envision may not always be the reality, but it's okay. You get to give yourself grace and permission to really tune into what your body needs and listen to your body. Sometimes that means I need to work out because I need to get my energy going and I need to get my blood flow through my body. And sometimes it means, yeah, I'd like to work out, but right now, like, my body is craving rest. And it just needs some time to rest. So that would be the third one, is grace.
Yeah, I like all that. I like the way that you said the whole serving others too, because it really does help us. Even if we are feel like we're busy and we serve somebody else, it gives us more time. It feels like we have more energy. And I used to always say to my kids too, that you love who you serve and you serve who you love.
That's beautiful.
Because you grow to love that person when you serve them. You, like you said, your friendships that you had back then, they grow to a deeper level because you're vulnerable in seeking help. And then they grow to love you more because they're serving you. And it's not just us loving the person that's doing it for us. They're growing to love you as well, because we love who we serve and we serve who we love.
Yeah, I had a neighbor at the time who
a neighbor
would see in passing, and I would just say hi to her. It wasn't like a deep relationship, but I remember one of the days I called her and I said, I really need help. Paul needs to stay home with the kids. I can't drive. I need to be taken to the hospital. I'm so dehydrated right now. I need IV. There's just something wrong. It was in the peak of the postpartum. And I remember she took me to the hospital. She sat by my side. And that whole next week, she came over every single day. She wasn't working at the time. She came over every single day and she sat by me and we laughed and we had fun. And she just sat there and just was accompanying me. And what I didn't know at the time, I thought she was helping me. But what I didn't know at the time was I was also helping her. She had PTSD from being in war. Wow. And she was going through a difficult time as well. And I had no idea. But her coming over and spending time with me and me spending time with her, we were helping each other out. And it was such a beautiful relationship that has been born out of me just reaching out to her and asking for help. She is not one of those neighbors now that I just ask for a cup of sugar. No, she is somebody that has actually moved away because she's military, but we still have this like deep connection with.
Yeah, it's like a silent healing because you're just sitting there trying to take it all in. That's why I like what you said about we're giving other people the experience to feel needed and wanted and important, which we tend to take away. And I don't know why that is. I think it's because we feel less than because we have to ask for help. We feel like we're being a burden to somebody else and that we think we're being judged. But, oh, she can't do this? Come on. Like, I've got 5 kids. Like, I did it. Meanwhile, I went through hell doing it. But we just don't let that side, that wall down. But when we break those walls and those vulnerabilities, it really allows for a community to happen. And I think, especially as women, we really need to come together and help each other and support each other. And especially through those dark times when we feel like everybody's judging us, like we can't handle it. And I also like what you said about, you know, even listening to our bodies, that our life does not have to look exactly like somebody else's life. They're on the treadmill at 5 o'clock in the morning. They're doing this. But we just don't know what goes on behind closed doors. And we just need to do what's right for our body. And if it means just sitting and relaxing and watching Netflix for a couple hours, but listening to what we need and not what somebody else is doing, that works for them. Yeah. Because that doesn't work for us.
In the book, I go through the weekly body scan. So it's a way of really being in tune with how your body is communicating to us. So our body is such a powerful tool and it does communicate to us when we're starting to see the signs of stress and overwhelm and burnout. So I take people through the weekly body scan and how they can identify the triggers that are causing the burnout. And then also I go into that whole, there's a chapter that talks about society's expectations and the expectations that we put on ourselves. Where does that come from? Sometimes it comes from parents. Sometimes it comes from what we see on social media. Sometimes it comes from the movies that we watch. And so I take people through all these different examples of where our viewpoint of what we think life and success should look like, where it stems from, so that we can have a high level of self-awareness and start to rewrite the story for us on what success looks like in our own terms, not somebody else's terms.
So true.
It's so easy to fall in that comparison trap. It's so easy to do. And that's why I believe that having a high level of self-awareness, what's causing burnout in your mind, what is that story that you're telling yourself on what you believe success should look like? When we have a high level of self-awareness, we can rewrite our own story and we can be more empowered, more fulfilled, live a more purposeful life and be happier.
Absolutely. Now, what got you to write this book? Where did it come from? Like, where did the idea come from?
Yeah. So I'll give a very brief abbreviated version of this story. But in 2020, after my husband had gotten home from deployment, that transition home was harder than I anticipated. I was a very different person. He was a very different person. I was used to making all the decisions of parenting on my own. Here he went from when he left, they were sleeping in cribs, they were learning how to talk, they were learning how to walk. Now he comes back and they're in toddler beds and they're formulating complete sentences and they're throwing temper tantrums. So he went from like the war zone of Iraq to the war zone of toddlers.
How long was he gone for?
A year, an entire year.
That's a long time, a lot of adjustment.
A lot of adjustments at that age too. Wow. Think about the adjustments between 1.5 and 2.5 years old.
And now he comes home and you're trapped.
Yeah. And he was. And the reason why I say that is because he came home right when we started to find our rhythm, March 8th, I lost my mom, and I lost my mom to suicide. So it was a tragic experience. And as I'm trying to cope and even comprehend that my mom's belief was the only decision to make was to end her own life, which was a permanent decision to a temporary problem. As I was coping through this, March 13th, so just 5 days later, the world shuts down with the pandemic. So he really was in a situation where he was trapped. Here he thought he was going to come home and we were going to go out to nice restaurants and we were going to do this. And now he's got a grieving wife and he's completely trapped and he can't leave his house. And then a couple months after that, the company that I was with was acquired by another organization. It became a very toxic work environment. So I'd been with the company for 7 years. I ended up leaving the organization and I felt so lost and confused and hopeless. I had tied my identity to my paycheck, to my job title, to my sales awards. I had a very successful, lucrative career in corporate America, and I left it and felt lost. And it took a lot of reflection and self-discovery to really identify what makes me happy, not based off what society says, not what social media says, not what job titles are, but what makes me happy. And that's what inspired the book. I said, there's been so many challenges that I've overcome in my life and some of the transformation that I've seen in my clients through my coaching clients or through the companies that I've worked with. I said, how can I empower people with these tools to have transformation in their life? How can they break through these roadblocks that are holding them back? How can they overcome adversity and build a career and life that they love? And that's what inspired the book.
It's very inspirational. And I think writing our story too is very therapeutic. I think writing it down healing. And knowing that we can help people. And what is the purpose of even going through it if we're not going to really use it as a guidebook and a survival guide for other people? And whether they use it or not, like you said, there's some things that they can relate to or not relate to. But all the lessons that we learn and all the trials and struggles that we go through, if we don't put it to use, it's like, what's the point of having gone through that? Yeah. And then it also offers us more compassion for somebody else, whatever their struggle. So I think struggles and trials and all of this is a blessing. Not maybe when we're going through it, we would rather opt out. But looking back at it, we're like, oh yeah, that I would totally do that again, even though we probably wouldn't in the thick of it. But because of what we learned, how it helped us grow, and then how it can help us to be so much more compassionate towards other people that are going through it. I'm sure that just a young mom or whatever just comes up to you and says a couple words and you're like instantly like loving her and loving on her because you go back to those exact emotions and those feelings that all of these different things that have brought you to understand.
Yeah. I say your mess is your message. Your pain is your purpose. And I believe that when we share our stories, it helps people feel like they're not alone. And whether you can relate to some of the stories that I've shared, I'm sure, or not, I'm sure you can relate to feeling burnt out, feeling overwhelmed, feeling maybe possible inner self-doubt, your inner critic consuming your mind, maybe sometimes feeling unworthy of something, maybe feeling lost or confused. If you felt any of those, then this book is for you.
That's awesome. I love it. I always get these little nuggets from people and then I'm like, I got to repeat that. So I'm sure some of my listeners are like, oh my goodness, Lisa, we've heard this a million times. But there's certain things. So I like that. Your mess is your message and your pain is your purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that. It's my new favorite quote now. So I'm glad that you said it. So where can people find your book? I know it's going to be when we launch this, it'll be coming out that day, I think. Right?
Yeah. So my book is Unstoppable Grit. Break through the 7 roadblocks standing between you and achieving your goals. And it's available on Amazon. And when they pre-order the book on Amazon or when you order the book on Amazon, you can go over to my website, daniellekobo.com, and you can get a free courageous goal setting guide.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. That's a nice addition. Okay, well, thank you very much for your time, Danielle. And good luck with your keynote speaking today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And thanks again for your message the other day. It's very rare that people reach out because I'm a religious person, but I like my podcast to be what everybody's story. So they might be religious, it might not be religious.
Yeah.
Whatever your people's story is, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't like to interject what my beliefs or feelings are, right?
In the same way.
Yeah. And so it was very refreshing and weird to say, oh, she's like asking what to pray for. Nobody's ever done. And so it's like when you don't really know a person very well. So yeah. I'm like, I appreciate that. So okay. Good luck with your book launch.
Thank you.
Good luck
with everything. Appreciate it. Have a good day.
Bye. And there you have it. Another episode, another incredible story with lots of nuggets of inspiration, motivation, and the knowledge you are not alone in your journey. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, share, and stay tuned for more captivating stories of strength and determination. Please see the episode description for more details and links about Danielle. Until next time, remember to be kind. You don't know what anyone is going through. If you are feeling down, reach out and help someone. It's truly the best way to feel happy. I'm your host, Lisa Helton, and you're listening to the Trust Your Friend Podcast. See you next week, my friends.